Hey everybody, I'm Scott, and this is Don't Buy Books. This one is going to be a little bit different than the last several, and that it's probably not going to translate to a chapter in the book. I wanted to do that, but it's just been too much of a pain in the ass to put together any kind of an outline before. I'm going to LA tomorrow, and I'm going to be gone for the week, so if I don't do it today, then I'm not going to be able to do one of these for another week. And it's already been a few weeks, I think, since the last one. So I want to get something out today. It might be a short episode, you know, but whatever it is, it will be something. So one thing that I wanted to cover today, and I think this, if I work on it a little bit, I might be able to massage it into not necessarily a chapter, but a concept that gets into the book, is obviousness. And in particular, obviousness is never, I think is a very general rule, never a good thing. I'm very skeptical about it as a general kind of, not necessarily universal thing, but certainly as a rule of thumb, it is almost always a bad sign. And what do I mean by that? Well, when there's something that you consider to be obvious, and you think, oh, this is obvious to me, therefore it's true, certainly not something that follows actually, and therefore it's obvious to everyone else, which is also not something that follows. And the reason the reason this came up for me, there was an immediate like proximal cause, but it's been more of like a general thing that's bothered me a lot over time, where I'll have a friend or someone that, you know, maybe even just an acquaintance, but somebody that I know, and they're talking about somebody and the situation that they have, and it could be all kinds of different things. It doesn't really have to be, you know, the details don't really matter, but whatever it is, that person has a problem, and they're often very annoyed. They're very irritated with somebody else, and the reason that they're irritated is because this other person doesn't see something that they consider to be obvious. And it frustrates the shit out of me, because essentially you're assuming that that person knows your internal state and can not only read your mind, but interpret things in the context that you've come to, you know, to think of them. So it's not just a matter of understanding where you're coming from, but they also have to understand kind of the thought process behind it. And so that first thing was a little bit confusing. I mean, it's not just your current state, but it's also how you got to that state. And so what seems completely obvious to you, because, you know, it's like, oh, I don't even have to tell somebody, this is obvious. Just because you think it's obvious doesn't mean that it's obvious to somebody else. And just because you think something is, you know, like if somebody doesn't get it, just because you think they should get it, doesn't really mean that they should. And I think this is a source of a lot of problems. I know so many friends who, they've either broken up over something like this, or they've had really big conflicts, you know, just gotten hyper pissed off at somebody, all because of something where they assumed that person knew something. Or conversely, I have friends where somebody else thought that they knew something or that it was obvious to them. They let it stew. They didn't actually air it out. And then eventually, like, it got to a certain point where they blew up and ended things. Yeah, but I keep coming back to relationships, but that's one place where it really blows up a lot. I think also professionally, this is a problem. So obviousness is, it has a lot of different shades and symptoms to it. Sometimes it's like something is obvious to you in terms of what somebody's duties or responsibilities are. Say somebody, you've hired somebody, or you just got hired to do something, and you don't lay out what that job entails, and it's not really clear, it's very easy for the person who is in charge, for the manager, to think, oh, this person should just obviously do X. And maybe it should be obvious to them, but assuming that it's obvious ends up creating conflict. Now, of course, I would say the big caveat here is don't assume that it's obvious to somebody else. Explain it to them. But once you've explained it to them, unless there's some kind of a communication breakdown, then I think you can assume it's obvious. And if it doesn't work out, well, that means something else. There's some fundamental problem there. So this is anyway just something that that bugs me a lot. And I don't know, it's such a ubiquitous thing that it always gets to me. And what I want to talk about more is not specifically that, other than just saying that part, but another problem with obviousness, and this is more in the sort of scientific or engineering domain. So there's a famous thing where people were making fun of Apple for patenting rounded rectangles. It's like, oh, they patented rounded rectangles. If you Google Apple rounded rectangles, you'll find a bunch of people being critical of them for these design patents and utility patents on the iPhone and other devices with rounded rectangles. And if you get hyper-reductionist, this is a more general problem, but it's very easy to be like super reductionist and take something that's actually a real problem and frame it in such a way that it sounds completely petty and absurd. And if somebody's not, I guess this relates in a sense to the bullshit detector, which is if you read a headline, especially a headline, but even a story or a summary, and you see something that just doesn't feel like it fits or doesn't feel like it makes sense, somebody got like fired over something that sounds completely, completely petty or inconsequential, you know, anything like this, whatever it is, they patented rounded rectangles. It sounds absurd, right? Anytime you see that, that should make your bullshit detector go off. And you should think, just in the same way that you think, you know, you didn't build that. It sounds wrong, right? If Obama actually said you didn't build that and meant you didn't build your business, it would be wrong. It would be fucking insane. And again, it's not just wrong because, you know, it wouldn't just be wrong logically for him to think that. But even if somehow he drew that conclusion, which is absurd, to actually say that for somebody who's a skilled enough politician to become president would be just fucking insane. Like, you know, you would have to have a brain tumor or a stroke or something really seriously wrong. So I think that kind of thing, and closely related to that, and I guess this actually goes into the obviousness that I was talking about before, but also this... this obviousness and absurdity thing. If you can interpret the situation in a way that is bad for somebody, but there's a more charitable interpretation, like that is to say, given the facts, there's an alternate explanation that is not so bad. I'm not saying that you should necessarily apply the sort of rhetorical principle of charity where you assume that, you know, whatever somebody says, they have the best possible intentions. I wouldn't say that that's a safe assumption, but you should at least consider that possibility. And you should probably, I would say all things being equal, maybe err slightly in the favor of that. Because if you don't, I mean, there's an interesting thing with game theory, where when you do multiple rounds of games like Prisoner's Dilemma, If you do one round, then the optimal strategy is very different than if you do multiple rounds. If you do multiple rounds, maybe I should explain Prisoner's Dilemma. So it's one of these things that to me seems so obvious, and yet if you're listening, maybe it's not. And even if you are, maybe I should just give context. So Prisoner's Dilemma and game theory more generally is the study of kind of interactions between players. So the players are agents of some sort. They're not necessarily intelligent beings, but they're things that see a situation and respond to it. So in this case, Prisoner's Dilemma is a game where you have two prisoners, you're both arrested, and you're separated. And you're separated, and the person who has arrested you is interrogating you says, you know, this other guy, if they talk first, then you get 10 years in jail. I'm picking arbitrary numbers. There are a bunch of parameters here, but yeah, you get the gist, hopefully. So if you're convicted and you don't turn over on the other person, say you get 10 years in jail. If they turn over on you, in that case, 10 years in jail for you, and they get a reduced sentence, let's say 2 years. If you turn over on them, you get 2 years, and they get 10 years. If you both turn over on each other, then you get, say, 4 years each. And if you both are able to hold your traps and not say anything, you both walk away. So you have these weights, the outcomes for these games. And those parameters actually determine what the optimal strategies are and what the optimal strategies are for a single round. Like if you're playing it one time and never playing again with that person, versus if you're playing with the same person over and over again. So it's interesting because you can, there are a lot of really intelligent, complicated strategies that you could try or you could think of. But the most effective one, generally speaking, is the category of sort of tit for tat. So you start out being generous and you cooperate. But then if they don't cooperate, you don't cooperate. And occasionally, maybe you randomly will cooperate after some number of rounds, even if they don't cooperate. You could call cooperating, you know, playing fair and not cooperating cheating. You could call it not cooperating if it's just the straight prisoner dilemma story. But in any case, you have this situation where you have two players and you have this set of outcomes depending on a single binary choice that both players make. And the outcome for both is determined by their own choice and the other's choice. So in this kind of a system, if you have miscommunications, then like you have something where you think somebody squealed on you and they didn't, you think somebody cheated and they didn't, at a certain point, the game thing gets pretty complicated and the optimal solutions become very, they have a sort of interesting properties as you're rolling this up. But at a certain point where miscommunication happens, I think it's about 50% of the time or more, the optimal strategies that are going to sort of win out on average end up not existing. And the reason for this is just you don't have enough information, no matter what, no matter how smart you are, to be able to judge correctly. And so when you're making assumptions, just to tie back to that, when you're making assumptions, if you're not judging correctly, if you're miscommunicating, and especially if you're miscommunicating, in this case, it wouldn't be more than half the time, but it would be because, you know, it's not a binary choice, it's sort of a continuum of choices. But if you're miscommunicating enough that you do not consistently get good information, then very quickly this will erode things, and things just end up bad for not only you and the other person, but for the group. So the total outcome, like the score that you'll get, the performance that you have will not be as good as it could be. The performance that they have will not be as good as it could be. And the outcome for the two of you collectively will not be as good as it could be. So all of this is, you know, reasons why obviousness is not, you know, just assuming something is obvious is always a bad choice. Getting back to the rounded rectangles, though, this is something that I think, I don't know, I feel like if you have never actually designed something or you've never worked through a problem that's really hard but has a solution that in retrospect seems obvious, then you don't have an appreciation for this. But there are many things where it's extremely complicated. think about the structure of DNA. The way that DNA works, the sort of helix with two sides, and basically the complementary pairs of nucleic acids, this double helix thing. Once you know how that works, it is so obvious for replication, transcription and translation, all of this stuff. It just seems like, of course, how else would it be? In order to get to that, like to actually have the realization that that was how it worked, even when people knew the chemical structure of DNA, just the, you know, like the molecular structure without knowing in three dimensions how it was laid out, even with that, not at all obvious. And I think this is one of those things where, you know, like, I mean, it was actually something that people had to think about for a long time and do a lot of experiments and a lot of research and a lot of math to come up with, and also a lot of thinking, like a lot of like deductive reasoning of, you know, how might this work to come up with this solution. And to me, this kind of thing is just, it is actually at this point for me, obvious, you know, in the sense that I've had enough experiences where you spend weeks or months working on something, even years sometimes, and you have an answer that I could, you know, like you could boil all of that time down to something that you could convey in a sentence or two. And that person that you've just explained that to, knowing the wisdom that you've acquired over that time and that you really earned through a ton of effort, they might think, you know, well, obviously. I find it kind of endlessly fascinating, these kinds of things, because one of the examples I always like to give is Zeno's paradox and calculus. So Zeno was a Greek philosopher around, like, I don't know, mid-400s BC. And he came up with not just one, but it's sort of a collection of these things where basically the idea was, in broad strokes, if you want to get from here to there, first you have to go halfway. And then you have to go halfway between there and where you're going. And then halfway between that half and the end. And so on and so on. And it turns out, no matter how many times you do this, there's always another step. So essentially, there are an infinite number of these halfway steps. And you have this infinite number of sub-steps that you have to make. How do you ever get to where you're going? Seems like a paradox. Like almost every paradox where, you know, somebody says it's a paradox, it's not actually a paradox. There's no paradox at all. The thing is, it's just missing a tiny, it's either missing or motivating, depending on how you look at it, a tiny bit of insight. And that tiny bit of insight is that, yeah, you have to go from here to there. And first you have to go halfway and then halfway. But if you're going at a constant speed, that first step takes you half the time. And that second step takes you a quarter of the time. And then an eighth and a 16th and a 32nd and so on. And because you're just taking these successively smaller bits of time to go a successively smaller bit of distance, even though it's an infinite sum, you actually get there in a finite amount of time. Now, the thing that's remarkable about this to me is that the Greeks were, you know, pretty good at math and pretty good at logic. And people between then and, say, Newton and Leibniz in the mid-1600s, so like basically 2,000 years later, between these two times, a lot of people thought about this, and it was just a crazy mystery nobody could figure out. That's probably not entirely true. I suspect there were probably some people who more or less got it, but didn't really write it down or didn't share it with other people. But in popular, you know, sort of like the known sciences that got passed down through the generations, nobody got it until these guys. And for some reason, roughly at the same time, like within, you know, years of each other, these two guys came to these realizations about calculus, and they basically created this thing which was like the study of taking these limits of successively smaller and smaller bits and then deriving some kind of finite things from that. So like whether you're looking at that traditional or sort of Zeno's paradox where you're going halfway, 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 and then trying to figure out from there what the total time is, that would be kind of like a, well, that's more of an infinite sum, but you could also look at it as an integration, or you could do other variations of Zeno's paradox where you're getting to differentiation, like looking at how things are changing over time and so on. And it's kind of remarkable because once you learn calculus, it seems so, obviously a lot of people think, oh, calculus is hard or it's confusing or whatever. I always blame, like, if you think that, I think you had a shitty teacher. I really do. Calculus, when you get it, is not, I don't want to say that it's easy, but it's definitely, at least in broad strokes, pretty obvious. And I would say, actually, to a certain extent, a lot of it is not so hard. And it's also something that, to be honest, in terms of control theory, robotics, and a lot of the stuff that I work on, calculus is like a daily thing that I use all the time. And it's one of the examples of things that I like to give for things that people think, you know, like, who's ever going to use, you're never going to use calculus in your life. Well, if you don't understand it, then you probably won't. But if you understand calculus, if you are a carpenter, you could find uses for calculus. If you're somebody who is working on almost anything that has some kind of, whether it has measurements or any sort of, like you're trying to build something, you're trying to make something, you probably have applications of calculus there. If you're trying to control something, for sure. And it's one of the things that always irritates me because it's something that is so powerful and so useful, and yet, and really not like that complicated or mysterious, and yet people think it's just, beyond them. It irritates me too, closely related, but physics. You tell people that you have a PhD in physics, and a lot of people, like, they almost look like they have pity on you. Like, oh, that's terrible. That's, I'm so sorry. It's the most bizarre thing. And it's kind of frustrating because, I like physics and I find it, I don't mean to imply that it's easy or obvious. And there are a lot of things that are not. There are a lot of things where it's some kind of a simple, in air quotes, problem that, anyone, even a kid, could think of. And then the actual thing is not solved. And maybe not even, clear that it's solvable. So there are things like that that, you just present this thing. Like if you pour a couple of drops, like you have a glass of water, you put a couple of drops of, say, red food coloring in it, and you see the pattern of how that's mixing. Understanding how that is mixing and that sort of chaotic, turbulent pattern, it is extremely complicated. It's one of the weird things in physics, actually, that you can figure out like the equilibrium states of things like that pretty easily. Like you wait an infinite amount of, or obviously a finite amount of time, but a very long time, which is effectively infinite, and things are completely thoroughly mixed. You can understand a lot about that system. And when you have the two things before they're mixed, it's a pretty simple system. You can understand it. That mixing requires a ton of understanding of fluid dynamics and chaos and things that are actually really, at the very least difficult, if not, I don't want to say intractable, but say open problems, like things that people have not solved yet. So that's, I don't know, it's interesting to me, but also very cool. But it's also, like there are plenty of things where they seem really complicated, and you can answer them. If you have 6.02 by 10 to the 23 atoms of hydrogen or molecules of hydrogen gas in a container, and you want to know how does that respond to shrinking the walls of the container? Seems like an insanely complicated problem. And I don't mean to imply that it's simple, but if you do statistical mechanics and you have the basic tools and math behind that, it's something that you can understand pretty quickly. Maybe not to like the perfect highest precision details, but in terms of broad strokes, you can understand it really well with a tiny bit of background in mathematics. And that kind of stuff, I mean, there's a quote from Einstein, "The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible." I always like that, just because I think it's one of these things that really contains a lot in, I guess actually it's one of these things also, not to get back to the theme, but it's one of these things where when you think about it, it's kind of obvious, but the amount of thought and, you know, philosophy and just consideration that it took for him to come to that conclusion, you know, that's a tiny little residue, but it's a residue that was formed after boiling down thoughts probably over the course of years. And, you know, just so much stuff that, you know, has come to be this insight that you can share. I think this is one of the cool things actually about quotes in general, where it's not that the quote is itself so profound, although it may have a kernel of wisdom that actually is really meaningful. Yeah, you know, it ain't what you know or what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. The Twain quote that I love. If you think about it, it seems completely obvious, but that realization and that ability to convey, like, once you have that realization, you can convey months or years of thought and the product of that to somebody in a sentence. I mean, you think about how remarkable that is. And I mean, I think this is one of the reasons humans like to pat themselves on the back and think, oh, we're so intelligent, we're so much more advanced than other animals. Well, ish, maybe. But when you look at it and you really consider what people, you know, like if you took an individual person and you isolated them from culture and any of this sort of bootstrapping stuff that, or any of the stuff really that gets them up to the level of a functioning person, and you let them figure stuff out on their own, what they can figure out in a lifetime is not that much. You know, even the most clever person in the world, the most clever person to have ever existed, they're not going to get that far. But when you take thousands and millions and billions of those over time, and you have this ability for them to take years or even a lifetime worth of insight and boil it down into things that you can convey in minutes to hours, and then you think, well, okay, now you've got that. You have a full lifetime worth of this person's thoughts, all reduced to this concentration process, to something that you can actually hold on to and hand, you know, like pass off really quickly. And you think about that, and you have not only that, but all of the other people who didn't have those kinds of thoughts. You know, you don't have to waste your time on that much. And the people who did, you know, and the people who supported that person going into that laid the groundwork for it, all of that stuff is conveyed there. And I don't know, this is one of these things that to me is just extraordinary, really, that you can have so much information in so, you know, terse a thing, like such a high density of wisdom. I'm not sure in terms of like information theory or, you know, like how you could quantify that. Like, you think about, you know, what are the possible sentences that you could have? There are many, many ones. Finding the few sentences that actually are profound out of that huge pool, it's, you know, I mean, needle in a haystack doesn't even begin to capture it. And yet there are so many things like this, and it's really remarkable to me. I think this is really, I feel like I've said remarkable a lot today, but it's really quite extraordinary that you can take that sort of stuff and give it to somebody. And then once you have a collection of these, you have essentially, I mean, you don't have all of the experience of that person's lifetime, but you do have hundreds or thousands or millions of people worth of these insights and realizations all fit into your head. And then you can take, to use another quote, "If I've seen further than most, it's only because I've stood on the shoulders of giants." Newton. So you think about it, and that is really, I mean, that's the crux of why humans are able to do the things that they can do. It's not that an individual human is that smart. And I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing. Like, I'm not saying that a dog is as intelligent as a human, but I've certainly observed, and it's been a year and maybe a quarter already since my dog died. But I used to watch her like look at things and try to solve problems. And then there were moments where you'd see like there's some cleverness in there. And I'm not saying that it was human level cleverness necessarily, but it was definitely not that far behind. And you think about it, like that kind of a mind that could live for 80 to 100 years. And you add to that education and communication, and what that thing could do is just, it's hard to imagine. Like it's kind of an interesting thing. Like you think about intelligent species, there are probably species on Earth now that are at least as intelligent as us, maybe even more individually. But for some reason, they don't have, like maybe they live in the water, so they can't manipulate things in the way that we could. Or they can't write things down. Maybe they don't, they have trouble with tool use. Maybe they have trouble with communication. Maybe, they're missing just like a tiny little piece. Once you add that piece in, and I mean, it's not a single piece. It's probably a handful or even a large collection of things. And each one of these is just a tiny little piece of the puzzle. But when you have all of those, you get this inflection. So you get, in terms of like growth of civilization and technology, before that you kind of, maybe you have a sort of steady state, or it's even creeping up slowly over time, but not very fast. And then you have these pieces come together, and then it diverges upward. It's, it's kind of, like people talk about technological singularities, like one in the future where AI comes and it's able to do extraordinary things, like that's the ultimate one and maybe even the only one. But in reality, we've had plenty of those in the past. So the formation, or like the printing press, written words, mathematics, any major thing in mathematics or engineering, whatever, the ability to smelt bronze or steel. Any one of these things has created an inflection in people's ability to do things that has really, in short period of time, made where they got almost inconceivable to where people were. And you think about, there was a time when people thought that the human carrying capacity of the planet was maybe order of a billion people. And it wasn't necessarily wrong, but the assumptions were wrong because, given where we were and the technology and the stuff that was available then, that might have been even true. But then you add the ability for fewer people to grow more crops. You add fertilizers, you add genetic modification, you add selection and so on. And then magically, you're able to do so much more that you might not even, it might have seemed insane that you could do that before then. Like, what, assuming that we don't kill ourselves and we don't get stuck in a rut forever, we will someday build something like an orbital ring. An orbital ring is essentially a space station that goes all the way around Earth. And there's a whole thing on, this is an aside that's not really on topic, but it's something that I think is worth talking about since I thought about it here. And in fact, actually, I would recommend, if you're interested in this, there's a guy on YouTube called Isaac Arthur, who talks a lot about all kinds of stuff like this, and really, a lot of insight and depth there. I'm just gonna scratch the surface, but every once in a while you hear about space elevators, Space elevators are very cool in concept. Like, essentially, you have an elevator that goes from the surface of the Earth all the way up to geosynchronous orbit, and then a little bit more. So the center of mass of the whole thing is in geosynchronous orbit, which means that it's going at the speed that the Earth is moving, which is really fucking fast. And so you have this thing that just goes upward that you can actually get on, like an elevator. You could have solar panels at the top, and you get on the elevator. If you get up the geosynchronous orbit and you get off, you just sit there. I mean, it's an insane fucking thing. And if you get off, you know, other places and you give yourself a little bit of a delta V to transfer yourself to the right orbit, you can either get into a nice orbit that's different, or you could get to escape velocity pretty easily. If you could do this, it gives you an insanely energy efficient way to get to space. You know, the problem is, and when I say insanely energy efficient, I mean, I'm ignoring the fact that you could put solar panels up there, and you could put a lot of them, and essentially that energy would be free. So it would be getting to orbit and getting to Earth escape velocity for nothing. And that's fucking nuts. The problem is, we don't have any materials, and we don't even necessarily theoretically have concepts for materials that could do this. We have some that, like carbon nanotubes, where if you could make carbon nanotubes that are the full length, or, you know, order of that, and they have like the best possible properties, maybe it would work. But it's a stretch. But even barring that, what you can do is make dynamic structures. So dynamic structures are things where you actually have, because you have this expenditure of energy, or if you have like superconductors and the ability to make like super hard vacuum and superconducting magnets, which basically lose nothing. If you could do that, then you could make these things with almost no energy expenditure. More realistically, you're going to have to keep speeding things up just because of friction. And you have electromagnets, which are really cool, but they're, you know, not the most efficient things. And they're getting heated from resistance and the wires. And so, you know, it ends up being bad, but you can build it. If you do that, energy goes into this thing, and like there are a bunch of examples of this, but the simplest one is the space fountain, or simplest by some definitions. And essentially all this is that you're throwing particles up really fast, and then you have at the top something that usually is a magnet that is pushing off of them. So that kinetic energy that's being used to push those things up is acting on the stuff at the top, and maybe across the, you know, maybe on the way up as well. And then they fall down and, you know, come back down, get reaccelerated and so on, and just are in a loop. That kind of thing lets you build structures that exceed the, you know, the engineering capabilities of, or the performance of any known material. You can just do really crazy stuff with them. So one thing you could do with this, and I think of the things that sort of the mega structures, this is one that is really cool and compelling, but you could build an orbital ring. And the orbital ring would be something that lives, yeah, maybe 100, 200 miles up, so not very high. And it's at a point where the orbital velocity of that thing would actually be pretty fast. So you think of like where the space station is. The amount of time that it takes to go one orbit, I think is order of 90 minutes. Pulling that out of my ass, so I could, you know, if I'm wrong, don't trust what I just said. You know, look it up. But it's something like that. So it's going around Earth pretty fast. But if you make a dynamic structure like this orbital ring, so you have this ring that's wrapped all the way around the planet, and in the same sense that you have the space fountain, you have something spinning in there really fast. And that, because you have this radial acceleration to keep it going in a circle, that holds it up, not actually orbit. Although I guess technically you would you would say that the mean momentum would probably be the same if it's statically stable there. But that's an aside. Essentially, just imagine it like you have this thing that's up there and it's moving like it's in geosynchronous orbit, but it's at an orbit where it's actually, you know, at the place where, say, the International Space Station is. Now, if you have that, which is a crazy amount of engineering, but feasible with materials that we have today, if you had asteroid mining and you were determined enough, you could build that today. As crazy as it sounds, it's totally reasonable. But once you have that, you can drop elevators down from there. And now, instead of getting out to geosynchronous orbit, which is pretty far out, you have these elevators that are a few hundred miles high. And that is in the range of something that you could actually build, either with dynamic structures or just with very advanced materials that we do have today. So here you don't have a space elevator anymore, in the sense that you have this geosynchronous thing that you need ridiculous materials to make. You have something that is just an elevator that takes you up to an orbital ring, and you can get up there pretty fast, you know, as fast as, you know, a bullet train traveling in a vacuum up to, you know, going a couple hundred miles. You have power again from space. And then once you're on there, you could have a launch accelerator. So you can either get up there, travel anywhere in the world. And the cool thing is you don't need reaction mass. So once you're up there, because you have the whole thing to push off of, you can get up, take a train to the other side of the world, and that train could be, again, you know, crazy fast, ridiculously fast. And then you get there, drop down on another elevator, and yeah, it might not be like as fast as a hypersonic transit where you could actually like take off in New York and then an hour later land in Tokyo, but it would be really fast. And in terms of energy and fuel consumption, it would be order of like a interstate train. And that's further, you know, like it's not that much energy, but on top of that, it's like all of this energy could be essentially free because it's coming from solar up at the top. So the cost to get to that altitude could be ridiculously low. And furthermore, once you're up there, in the same sense, like you make that train, well, if you take that and you spin something up to a very high speed and then you let it go, you can launch into a transfer orbit from there that either takes you to, you know, you apply another delta V to insert into another orbit, or it just takes you to escape velocity and you're either flying around the solar system or someplace else. That kind of thing, I mean, it's just like insane to think, but it's totally, it is something that if we were determined to do today, unlike the space elevator, like the space elevator, when you think about the amounts of materials and like just the engineering challenges behind it, especially the materials that just don't exist yet, really is hard. This thing is something where you could imagine building it today. And when I say imagine building it, I mean, if you were really determined, like we had a very compelling reason and you didn't mind putting probably the GDP of not such a small country toward it, you could build it. Maybe even much less than that. So, yeah, it's total aside, but although I will say, actually, to get back onto the subject, that you can build something like that is, I think, obvious, but it would not be at all obvious if you didn't have an introduction to it. Before I heard about orbital rings, never even occurred to me. Once you understand that it's a concept that you could, and you think about how you would do it, it's all very straightforward, and it's kind of cool and beautiful to me in that sense. So anyway, I think I could go off for a little bit longer, but I think that's where I'm going to cut it for today. Next time I do one of these, I'm going to try to get back to the chapter thing. I really have to get to that and then start dialing it in. My informal goal is to have something by the end of Well, let's just say this. I wanted to say by the end, or like by the election of 2018, but I think in time for the election of 2020, I would like to have something, so like say end of 2018 and maybe get it published in 2019 so that it's known, hopefully, by 2020. And ideally, you know, there's a tiny little stone pushing against the re-election of Trump, assuming that, you know, he makes it there. And I tell you, I go back and forth between thinking that's almost a certainty and it's almost an impossibility. And I honestly just don't know which it is. With that, thank you for listening. I will be back next week or sometime in the indeterminate future. Take care and zaijian.